Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to today's program. We have a lot to share. We're going to talk about why are some parents very much opposed to mandatory vaccines. By the way, they're also opposed to sugar in the diet of their children. Oh, and they're also opposed to genetic modified foods, but other parents are not. I'll share that insight with you. Then we're going to look at a new study that shows that strokes are increasing in younger people. A lot of them. Big increase. Also, there's new research out showing that the alpha glycerol phosphorylcholine that many of you have been using is a real brain-enhancing, memory-boosting, improved concentration and focus nutrient. Lots of good studies on that. Coenzyme Q10, it's cutting death rates big time in heart patients. And also German athletes are using coenzyme Q10 to boost their power. A lot on health and nutrition. On the environmental segment, I'm going to show you two things that interface. First, how grassroots individuals are standing up and saying no to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a major treaty that has nothing to do with helping any American. But it also is a part of how fascism is manifesting in the United States today. That said, I have written and shared numerous commentaries of my own on fascism. Today, I'll be sharing one from Op-Ed News, Wiley Scanlon. Fascism has come to roost in America. Also today, What Must Be Done About Monsanto Corporation and Why, by Green Shadow Cabinet Ecology and General Welfare Branch. A group of empowered environmentalists are talking about Monsanto. I'll share the latest. The number one brand of children's vitamins in America today, they've included aspartame, GMOs, cupric acid, coal tar artificial coloring agents, sorbitol, hydrogenated oils, and cornstarch. Why? We'll deal with that. I may have a guest, if they're able to make it into studio today, Linda Tucker, who grew up in South Africa during apartheid, and she is going to talk about saving the highly endangered white lion from extinction, one of Africa's most sacred animals. And she also will be a part of our conversations with Remarkable Minds if she's able to get into studio. She's trying, and we'll hopefully see her in studio. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. There is a major campaign right now around the United States where parents are educating their children and other parents about the lack of safety and efficacy in vaccines, both individual and collective vaccines. Historically, the federal government and the media has made it seem as if only uneducated, superstitious, and irresponsible parents would not vaccinate. But of course, just the opposite is true when you look at the facts. It is the most educated of parents who are doing the most when it comes to vaccines. This is the latest on this topic. Quote, the education level of parents has an influence on the frequency with which their children eat foods linked to obesity and if they will be vaccinated. The children of parents with low and medium levels of education eat fewer vegetables and fruit, eat more processed food products, including genetically modified foods. They are 70% more likely to receive vaccinations. Highly educated people are avoiding vaccines. Before 1998, highly educated parents were up to 8% more likely to take up the MMR vaccine than parents with lower education. But that has changed. This gap is now not only closed, it's actually been reversed. with highly educated parents being less likely to accept the MMR vaccine. And that's the newest on that, and that was shown because more educated parents are using the internet, looking up articles, then looking at the quality of the article, and finding, gee whiz, there's more propaganda about why we should vaccinate, but there's not good science on the safety and efficacy. And they don't want an experimental drug or harmful drug going into their children, and they are correct. Normally, when you hear about people getting stroke, it's an older individual, generally a postmenopausal woman, for several reasons. Many of the protective hormones are diminished. There's an imbalance between progesterone and estrogen, and that balance is crucial for protecting a woman's heart. Also, a woman frequently gains weight because her metabolism shifts downwards. And this is mainly fat. And as a result, the higher the incidence of fat, the more likely you are to have a stroke. But that's not the case today. Today, according to a University of Cincinnati College of Medicine study, they're finding more common strokes happening in younger people. And, quote, this is a disturbing trend. And that is crucial that we understand that. In fact, they're finding very increased rates of stroke in people under 55. And historically, that has not been the case. Why? Well, let's just put this in perspective. First, because people today under 55 are more often than not financially challenged, or they're being cut back in their careers, or they're having to seek an alternative career. They frequently have gone through such stress that it's adversely affected their relationship or caused the ending of the relationship. At the same time, they frequently have children who are in school and are then weighing what has to be done in order to keep the kids in school, which they know is important for the kids' future, but they often can't afford it. Now, imagine this. Imagine there was a time when you were happy, you had a family, you had a home, you had a good career, you worked hard, and then one day it begins to unravel, generally when you're downsized or benefits are taken away or your job is outsourced. With that, then you have to make adjustments, but more often than not, people don't want to make too radical an adjustment because they think, well, things will get better, but they don't. They get worse. So instead of becoming very prudent, they keep up the lifestyle to keep up appearances, and that costs them. And then one day they run out of their savings, and then they run out of money, and then frequently they're out of their home, and then sometimes they're out of a relationship. But life still goes on. You still have responsibilities. That causes stress. And stress is a major reason for stroke. But then when people are highly stressed, more often than not, they rely upon junk food, comfort foods. And most Americans today, under 55, are consuming an enormous amount of processed foods. And those foods frequently contain trans fats. And they're eating more processed meats. Remember, every time you have a pizza with pepperoni, you're having a processed meat. They're drinking a lot of diet soda. And they're also consuming alcohol. All of those I just mentioned contribute to stroke. Now, there is one good thing you can do for your brain that is now being recognized with some good science to support it. And here's what it is about. I've been talking about this for a long time, so many of you are already consuming the alpha-glycerol phosphorylcholine, and it's derived from soy extracts, and it's used in Europe for treating Alzheimer's and dementia, but not in the United States. Here's what we know about it, and it just, you can go by the initials GPC. It delivers choline across the blood-brain barrier rapidly, and that increases a chemical in the brain called acetylcholine. And acetylcholine supports better memory and overall brain functioning. it generally stimulates the cognitive areas of the brain. When there's a predominance of alpha-GPC, the phosphatidylcholine necessary for nerve and muscle and health cell is synthesized more easily by the body. It supports greater activity by surrounding the nerve transmissions. In fact, a new study proves that more physical activity can make you smarter. And this nootropic supports that by providing more energy. So the phospholipids are greatly supportive of the liver and the lipotropic functions, which means it can more easily get rid of excess toxins. So it's one way to help detoxify the body of fats or alcohol or simple carbohydrates. It gets rid of the toxins. And it helps boost the human growth hormone, which begins to decline about, somewhere in our 20s. And the human growth hormone is made in the pituitary gland and governs a lot of body functions, including muscle mass. And that's why as people age, they start to lose muscle mass because they're losing human growth hormone. So this helps support that. And it supports better brain and nerve communications so that it makes the brain more agile. So just one good thing we can do today is just increase the amount of GPC, glycerol phosphorylcholine. Now, another nutrient that's making the news and having a lot of benefit in people's body is coenzyme Q10. From the European Journal of Heart Health, an article entitled "The Effects of Coenzyme Q10 on Morbidity and Mortality in Chronic Heart Failure, Results from the Q-Symbio Study." In lay language, here's what it says. That coenzyme Q10 was able to cut death by half in patients with heart failure. And that was research done in Denmark and presented at the annual Heart Failure Association of European Society of Cardiology. So coenzyme Q10 can make a big, big improvement. And it can help save your life. But you got to take it in supplement form. Quite simply, there's not enough coenzyme Q10 in foods for heart failure patients. My suggestion, between 200 to 300 milligrams, 2 to 3 times a day. But another study on coenzyme Q10, and this one was in Germany, showed that 100 German athletes had found daily supplements of 300 milligrams of Q10 significantly boosted their power performance. So one more reason to use coenzyme Q10 if you're out there power walking, biking, all good. And finally today, something that we should be consuming more of, and that's coconut oil. Coconut oil is really good for you. But there's a lot of reasons why it's good, and most people are not using it. Coconut oil contains a small percentage of the healthy unsaturated fats, and they're also found in abundance in olive oil. And about one-third of the fat in coconut oil is composed of a palmitic acid, and that also impacts your cholesterol level. And the medium-chain fatty acid is called lauric acid, and that helps raise the good HDL cholesterol levels in the body. And that's why some people believe that coconut oil is beneficial for your heart. Coconut oil is actually listed under coconuts as a fruit, like the peach and the olive. And there's a lot of evidence that coconut oil is important for our well-being. So, just some things to think about. I'm Gary Noll. Now on to the environmental segment. I'm going to share some insights with you from a group of individuals, including Ronnie Cummins, who is the director of a major organic movement in the United States. Here's what it has said. Quote, "The Monsanto Corporation is a top corporate climate criminal whose drive for profit and control of the global food system threatens food safety, biodiversity, and food sovereignty. Monsanto is the world's leading producer and proponent of genetically modified agriculture. Through aggressive purchases of seed companies, Monsanto is rapidly taking control of the world's seed supply. In addition, Monsanto produces dangerous chemicals that poison communities, add toxics to the food supply, and create superweeds that require increased application of even more toxic herbicides. Monsanto also promotes farming practices that severely exacerbate climate change by requiring excessive water and energy, and promoting massive deforestation to promote land for genetically modified agriculture. Monsanto uses its political connections and market power to intimidate farmers and create a near monopoly on seed, creating a fragile, homogeneous food supply, as well as to protect themselves from liability for their actions. As more information becomes available, it is clear that Monsanto's practices threaten the future of our ability to grow food and live healthy lives. Immediate steps must be taken to preserve our food system and our future. We recommend the following actions. Immediate moratorium on development and certification of new pesticides and genetically engineered crops. A long overdue, thorough science-based examination of GMOs and pesticide safety by scientists not tainted by the revolving door of financial ties to agribusinesses, and an urgent phasing out of existing GMOs and pesticides not demonstrated to be safe for people and the environment. This would begin immediately, targeting highest-risk GMO pesticides first. Clear labeling of all foods containing genetically modified organisms. Immediate creation of economic and agricultural supports to expedite conversion from toxic industrial agriculture to sustainable organic farming, which is healthy for people, the environment, and our economy. Urgent public investment in crop breeding to increase the supply of a broad diversity of traditional seeds to meet our agricultural needs. Public investment in research and education on agroecological and organic farming practices. Make Monsanto pay for cleanup of the environment through remediation of the supply of traditional seeds, remuneration to farmers whom they have adversely affected, and the ongoing cost of health effects caused by their products. End production of ethanol for fuel until it can be done in a way that does not adversely affect access to food and does not consume more energy than it produced. End Monsanto's influence over governmental agencies. As a start, FDA Deputy Commissioner for Foods, Michael Taylor, must resign from his position, and the Monsanto Protection Act must be repealed. Food production needs to serve the function of nourishing our communities, and food production needs to be transformed to sustainable, primarily local and organic agriculture that uses less water and energy, and creates better soil and healthier food. Monsanto takes the global food system in the opposite direction, towards increased use of pesticides, increased use of energy and water, a less biodiverse agricultural system, and a food supply of unknown safety. End quote. I certainly would agree that that makes a great deal of sense. Now for a commentary, and then a follow-up, shorter commentary on the very dangerous but ongoing efforts at the Trans-Pacific Partnership. First, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Quote from Common Dreams. Following the most recent round of the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations in Lima, Peru, more than 150 organizations have come out against such international trade agreements, calling them a deadly weapon against democratic rule, the protection of individual rights, and environmental justice. Quote, these agreements further consolidate the asymmetry of laws that propagate that the rights and power of corporations are protected by hard law and are above the rights of people and communities, writes the group in an open letter. We believe that nation states should not have should not only have the obligation but also the full freedom to implement laws and policies in favor of the people and the environment without the threat of being sued by transnational capital. End quote. According to the Alliance, which includes Global Exchange and Global Trade Watch and Institute for Policy Studies, under international investment treaties such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a co-signed country can be sued by a transnational corporation if their laws or policies go against the interests of the corporation, and such as legislation that favors people over the environment. International investment agreements grant unprecedented rights to foreign corporations as investors. They are deadly weapons against democratic rule and the protection of people's rights. So my suggestion is this. First, let your legislator know that if they at any point vote for or support the Trans-Pacific Partnership that is made up of 600 lobbyists, all working for private major corporations against your best interest, you'll vote them out of office, and this is something you're against. And then we should start a major grassroots movement to boycott all of the corporations involved in this. Within the next week, I will have a list of all the corporations and their sponsors, and we will then start to make it go viral. If they are supporting this, it means that they're against the American people and the environment, in which case we should be against them and not buy their products. I'm going to share now a commentary called Fascism Has Come to Roost in America. It's from Op-Ed News. I will have it posted on our website. And it's from Wiley Scanlon. Here's what he says. As the famous American novelist Sinclair Lewis, who was the first American to be awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, once said, "When fascism comes to America, it'll be wrapped in the flag and carrying the cross." The ever-rising culture of militarism in America and the never-ending conflict of war in faraway countries like Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and hundreds of military bases that are needed for that effort, this all ends up supporting America's own fascism movement. From support of the State of Israel and its apartheid against the Palestinian people to the murders of more than 1,000 civilians in Pakistan by American drone strikes to the extrajudicial murders and their attacks and efforts to ignore the basic civil liberties guaranteed to every person in America via our Constitution, yet fascism has arrived in America. We can see it every time a politician gets up to speak, and we can hear it in the rhetoric that is used from media reports to speeches. We used to call America our country, but now the official term is homeland, much like Hitler used the word fatherland. I cringe every time I hear the word. George W. Bush used the rhetoric of fear through lies to bring us to invade Afghanistan and Iraq. Obama has used the same rhetoric again and again, and lately on May 22nd in a speech at the National Defense University. Mr. Obama said, quote, "Our nation is still threatened by terrorists from Benghazi to Boston. We've been tragically reminded of that truth, but we have to recognize that the threat has shifted and evolved from the one that came to our shores 9/11. With a decade of experience now to draw from, this is the moment to ask ourselves hard questions about the nature of today's threats and how we should confront them," end quote. Simply stated, America has no business interfering in the internal affairs of other countries unless it is invited. In Pakistan, just today, its Supreme Court ruled that American drone strikes within Pakistan borders are illegal, an infringement on its sovereignty, and therefore should be shot down by the military. Americans should not preach about freedom of religious expression and speech on the one hand while denying another country to govern its citizens in accordance with their laws and culture. This is exactly what Adolf Hitler did when he annexed Austria and Poland. In my on-linguistical examination of media reports and speeches, plus the actions and reactions of America's evolution towards fascism, I found several repetitive characteristics that identify America has crossed the line toward becoming a fascist nation. One, powerful and continuing nationalism. Fascist regimes tend to make constant use of patriotic mottos, slogans, symbols, songs, and other paraphernalia. Flags are seen everywhere, as are flag symbols on clothing and in public displays. 2. Disdain for the recognition of human rights. Because of fear of enemies and the need for security, the people in fascist regimes are persuaded that human rights can be ignored in certain cases because of the so-called need. The people tend to look the other way or even approve of torture, summary executions, assassinations, long incarcerations of prisoners, such as at Guantanamo, where 165 prisoners have been held for more than 10 years without being charged for a crime. The assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki and his son in Yemen by American drones without the right of due process under our Constitution to the recent efforts of the FBI. 3. Identification of enemies as scapegoats as a unifying cause. The people are rallied into unifying patriotic frenzies over the need to eliminate a perceived common threat or foe, racial, ethnic, and religious minorities, liberals, socialists, perceived terrorists. Muslims in particular are singled out in America by law enforcement agencies and viewed with suspicion and have been the target of neoconservative so-called patriots. 4. Control mass media. Sometimes the media is directly controlled by the government, but in other cases the media is indirectly controlled by government regulation or sympathetic media spokespeople or executives. The recent AP scandal against journalists by Eric Holder, the Obama administration, and the FBI are a perfect example. 5. Religion and government are intertwined. Governments in fascist nations tend to use the most common religion in the nation as a tool to manipulate public opinion. Religious rhetoric and terminology is common from government leaders, even when the major tenets of the religion are diametrically opposed to the government's policies and actions. Every speech ends with, "God bless the United States of America." Before 9/11, that phrase was seldom used. 6. Corporate power is always protected. The industrial and business aristocracy of a fascist nation often is the ones who put the government leaders into power, creating a mutually beneficial business-government relationship and power elite. Super PACs and corporate lobbyists like Karl Rove and the Koch brothers are abundant now in America. They are the ones that our leaders listen to, not the poor, the middle class. Rampant cronyism, 7, and corruption. Fascist regimes always are governed by groups of friends and associates who appoint each other to government positions and use government power and authority to protect their friends from accountability. Think Clinton, think Reagan, think Bush, think Obama. All corrupt, all crony, all corporate. Fraudulent elections. Sometimes elections in fascist nations are a complete sham. Other times elections are manipulated by smear campaigns against or even assassinations of opposition candidates. Use of legislation to control voting numbers or political district boundaries and manipulation of the media. The GOP redistricting scams and voter suppression proposals now have been introduced in 41 states. 9. Obsession with crime and punishment. Under fascist regimes, the police are given almost limitless power to enforce laws. The people are often willing to overlook police abuses and even forego civil liberties in the name of patriotism. Rodney King was only the beginning. Every 36 hours, an African-American is killed by a police officer. New York's stop-and-frisk policy of black and Hispanics is one example of that abuse. In early July of 2012, the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, a grassroots organization, released a report entitled Report of the Extrajudicial Killing of 120 Black People. The report examined the murders of 120 black men and women by police officers and security guards or self-appointed law enforcement in just a six-month period of that year. According to the report, the killings are considered extrajudicial because they happen without a trial or due process or against international human rights standards. The most important and outstanding revelation in the report is during those 6 months, a person of African descent was executed every 36 hours. Therefore, police violence against black people occurs far more often than reported. Many of the 120 killed were young. 11% were just children. Number 10, disdain for intellectuals in the arts. Fascist nations tend to promote and tolerate open hostility to higher education and academia. Just look at the Paul Ryan budget proposals that severely cut education funding in the arts while increasing defense spending. Liberals and progressives are often, they're not the same by the way, are often viewed by neoconservatives and teabaggers as being anti-American. WorldNet Daily columnist Eric Rush writes that the government should prosecute liberals and members of the press, quote, in order to defend freedom and, of course. He accuses journalists of treasonous collusion with the Obama administration, said the founders would have wanted journalists to be, quote, found guilty of high crimes. Sinclair Lewis was correct when he said that when fascism arrives in America, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross. End quote. Those are his thoughts. I've shared mine on numerous occasions about fascism in America. When major businesses and government join together, that's fascism. Then what rights do we have? We don't. And one final notion before we go to our break. I have said on many occasions that the problem on the left, one of the gazillion problems on the left, is their inability to engage in true impartial scholarship to look at the facts. Do we need government? Yes, because we need that which protects and enhances the commons, that which we all should be sharing together, our lakes, our parks, our rivers, to keep our infrastructure strong and functional and up to date, to have quality education and health care, and to have those services necessary for a civil and sane society to function together. This is not about politics. This is about what we all should be sharing, where no one fears walking down a street. And no one fears that if there's a fire in your house, that you will not have someone come quickly and try to put it out. But then what we have is we are told that what we need is a bigger government, and that by getting more people hired by the government, that will help us. And I say, prove it. I say, let the government be the size necessary to function with outside oversight and not without cronyism. What we have today is a massively bloated, completely corrupt, dysfunctional bureaucracy laden with technocrats, bureaucrats, and overseen by policy-making appointed people from special industry groups that serve their interest. Think of Michael Taylor at the FDA. But that's true of every agency. Now head of commerce, Mrs. Pritzker. They overlooked her $80 million loss of memory about how she did her taxes. She's the one who put Obama in power. I've taken the time to look at what we actually spend money on. And 80% of everything we spend money on is wasted, unnecessary, and yet we do not challenge it. The military-industrial complex, we could easily protect America from terrorist threats and defend ourselves on $200 billion a year. That would save us $1.2 trillion a year. If we have one flat income tax that all corporations and businesses had to pay with no deductions, we could eliminate the IRS, and that would give us an additional $1.5 to $2 trillion in income. If we forgave all the money outside the United States and offshore accounts, it's $33 trillion, one-time flat tax. Suddenly, we're up to almost eliminating an awful lot of our national debt. If we got rid of the IRS, got rid of the Federal Reserve, and let the Treasury print money and loan it where needed for zero interest, as it once did, then we no longer are paying $500 billion a year to service our debt, and most of that goes to banks that should have been given it to. But then you start to realize that these agencies wouldn't need to exist, and their only purpose is for their own perpetuation. Here's just one example, and these statistics come from the Department of Energy's Loan Program Office. I've said, just look in any agency of government, you'll see massive bureaucracy, massive waste, massive corruption. This is one example. In 2008, then-candidate President Obama or Barack Obama, promised to create 5 million green jobs if elected president. The Department of Energy gave $26 billion in loans. This is just one department of government, by the way. Gave out $26 billion. Now, one company, Georgia Power, got $8.3 billion, and another, which was a front-end nuclear, got $2 billion. And this is just in the energy section. So what did we get for $26 billion? We got 2,298 permanent jobs. Okay, that's not 5 million. It's 2,298. That means here's what it cost to hire each person. $11,450,000 per job created. Let me repeat that. 11,450,000 jobs. Dollars per job created. So no, every time they make a promise, they lie. But then who got the $26 billion? The companies got it. That's who always gets it. So why don't the people wake up, take a look at what's actually happening, do the scholarship, do the research, do your homework, and you'll see how you've been used, lied, manipulated consistently. And now they're trying to make it so that if you inspect or criticize or condemn any of the abuses, the fraud, the crimes of the state, that that puts you in the line of fire as being sympathetic to terrorism. If you report crimes against animals on farms, you, by the FBI, a fascist agency with a terrible history, you become a terrorist in their eyes and will be prosecuted as such. The people perpetrating the crime on animals? Nothing. They're political donors. They're always protected. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. My guest is in studio, Linda Tucker. She grew up in South Africa during apartheid and attended universities in Cape Town and Cambridge in the UK. She's the founder of the Global White Lion Protection Trust, a nonprofit devoted to protecting the white lions from extinction in their natural habitat in South Africa. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We normally don't think about white lions, nor do we see pictures of them very often. And it's almost always the golden lion that we recognize immediately. However, the much rarer white lion is not albino. So please begin with sharing some of the unique qualities of the white lion within the cat family and what distinguishes it from the golden lion, such as their unique genetic signature. Then I feel your personal story of being rescued in the wild from a lion pride by a medicine woman whose name meant lion queen, and how you became fully committed to preserving and rewilding the white lion would be of interest for our listeners.
Well, thank you, Gary. Of course, scientists assumed that the white lions were albino, but that was disproved in 1997. They are, in fact, the result of a very rare genetic trait, which is unique to one region on Earth. So that's called an endemic region. And this region is regarded as a sacred site by the indigenous elders of Africa. And the name of the region is Tsimba Vati. You hear the word Tsimba for lion, Vati, to come down from the heavens. So the name of the word of the site where these unique animals were born means the place where the star lions came down. So they are they're the stuff of myths and legends, and they're also really important from a conservation perspective because they're unique to one area. Their genetics was a great curiosity. And my organization that I founded, the Global White Line Protection Trust, has been working collaboratively with geneticists around the world, including the states in Maryland, China, Korea, and the UK, to crack what is known as the genetic marker. It took 7 years, but we finally found the needle in a haystack, and we have identified the genetic code that makes these animals unique. That is the evidence that we need to take our campaign further and have them protected by international law, because at the present time, abominably, there is no law on earth that protects them, either from being hunted in the wild or worse, being hunted in cages, which is a malpractice that is taking place in South Africa called canned lion hunting, and it's legalized in our country.
Hmm. The primary cause for the demise of the white lion, which was almost technically extinct in 1994, has been poaching and trophy hunting. In the wild, it only inhabits a relatively small part of the earth. So a region, I believe, called the Tembati. However, there are many other species being threatened with extinction due to poaching and hunting, but I'd like you to speak at some depth about the large international criminal syndicates that are engaged in trophy hunting, and particularly those involved in the white lion, and how Americans are especially contributing these animal endangerment issues. And in your answer, also speak a little about the industry of breeding trophy animals, such as the white lion and other, in cages, and then simply shooting them.
Yes, well, the reason that they became technically extinct in 1994 was because of all these artificial removals from their natural habitat into zoos, circuses around the globe. And that includes, of course, Siegfried and Roy's show that made them a billion-dollar industry. They originate from this one region on Earth, which is, in fact, the epicenter of a massive biosphere that was declared by the United Nations the Kruger to Canyons biosphere. So this unique animal, which is the apex predator in its ecosystem, is actually the key to protecting the entire ecosystem, the biodiversity of a vast area, over 400,000 hectares. Now, with all these artificial removals, they were not seen in the wild for almost two decades. But their genetics exists in the golden lions of that region. So every now and then, two golden lions carrying this rare code would produce a snow white lion cub. And of course, it was removed from the wild almost immediately, as I say, into zoos and circuses. But the worst is that these cubs were removed and put into these captive breeding centers, and they were bred, hand-reared, and then put in cages, sometimes not even released before they were hunted. It's not hunting. I mean, it's cage slaughter.
Okay. Have you found any evidence that these trophy crime syndicates have government protection?
Well, first of all, the depressing statistic is that 50% of lion trophies coming out of Africa are American trophy hunters. Then secondly, yes, our organization, the Global White Lion Protection Trust, has been campaigning to shut down this industry a lot, along with other animal welfare organizations the world over. This went to court in South Africa. It went through the court processes, the High Court, and then once it got to the Supreme Court, it was mysteriously passed, and now it's legalized in our country. So, you know, the hope that I have actually is that a symbol like this, the king of all animals, and it's a sacred symbol. Truly, there's a lot of legend and myth around it, which is fascinating and demands attention. It links all the way back through Egyptian mythology and right back to Khoisan, Bushman knowledge. These animals were believed to be in spiritual terms, they were believed to be the firstborn of God's creatures on earth, symbolizing the fact that their genetics goes back to previous ice ages, and that their occurrence now is part of a prophecy which indicates that they are precursors to climate change. You know, that they are snow animals ahead of their time, basically.
I understand. And the jaguar is highly esteemed spiritually among the indigenous tribes. I met them when I was meeting with the shamans in the Amazon in Central America. And the Indian Bengal tiger has been sacred to yogis and the tribal groups going back millennia. And, of course, you have the famous snow leopard, which is revered by Tibetans. And there's even a snow lion statue at the entrance of temples in Nepal and Tibet. However, even though the first white lion was not observed in the region of South Africa until 1938, very recent, there's a long tradition of the sacred. So we understand that. But it doesn't mean that we, as human beings, will look at others as sacred, and that's unfortunate. We more often than not look at them as what can we use them for, and that's why so many lions are bred in China, because of its supposed aphrodisiacal properties. I just wish someone would do a really good profile, psychological profile. Who are the people most likely to go out into a truck and look at a grazing animal and shoot it and then put its head or body, stuff it, and put it on a wall? I'd like to know, what are the kind of sociopathic personality and disturbed qualities of that person? And then I'm afraid we'd end up seeing too many people who are in power in this country. But my next issue is more important than my own feelings about who's doing this and why they're doing it. What I found most alarming is that these big cats are not listed as endangered. In fact, they're not even considered threatened by international agencies and the South African government. And that's part of why I have the contempt I do for your South African government. And even if a species is given threatened status, it is still legal to hunt them. And first, define for us the different status terms we hear given to species, such as protected or threatened or endangered. And then, what have been the political and social pressures and obstacles that you've confronted in preserving the white lion? And why would an animal that is extremely rare not be protected and legally permitted than to be abused and slaughtered?
I think it's the issues that you cover daily. And I think just to touch briefly on this psychological profile, it's indicative of the consumer society that has gone, you know, to insane levels where anything can have a price on its head if you pay for it, you know. And so the solution to this is not to talk in financial terms, but much greater economic terms about sustainability of our planet. And, you know, we're looking at whether species will survive for our children, let alone our grandchildren. Now, that is a much, you know, that is looking at economy in its real terms, not just, you know, how much money trophy hunting brings into our country today while killing the sustainability of our future.
Part of your work, thank you, I appreciate that insight. Part of your work now, besides managing to get the lions recognized as at least a threatened species, to start rewilding them in nature. What are the primary obstacles that you're facing in this project? And, for example, about a month ago, we were told that some of your lions on the preserve have been poached, killed. So hunting as a threat remains, but what are the other challenges you're confronting?
Well, Gary, you know, there are a lot of challenges. And my book that's just been published on Endangered Species Day takes the reader through the whole journey with me from that moment you alluded to, right at the beginning, when I was rescued from a pride of lions by an extraordinary woman who was an indigenous medicine woman who walked on foot at night through the pride of lions, actually carrying a baby on her back to show how fearless she was, and came to my rescue. That's chapter one of the book. And then it goes into all the trials and the tribulations and the challenges you describe. But it also describes the triumphs. And I think that's worth remembering, that, you know, this work in support of our beloved Mother Earth, you know, it's going to be challenging for anyone out there taking up any cause. But the rewards are so worth it because you're on the right side. And, you know, I personally believe that Mother Nature is stronger than anything humans can, you know, exploit or try and destroy in her. The only question is, are we going to survive with her, or are we going to be wiped out by the changes that are taking place in our Earth?
Linda, let me share with you a suggestion. You tell me whether you think this has any merit or not, all right?
Right.
I believe that we have to have some affinity for that which is sacred and that which we will then go out of our way to preserve. And that's why I believe that we have to readjust ourselves. For example, what would I do? I would take a white lion, if you have an abandoned cub that you can raise, and then film raising that cub to show what a baby lion is about, so that we begin to see this lion as something we can identify with. When we did this with baby seals, suddenly people were outraged that these baby seals were being clubbed to death. When we did it with capuchin monkeys, showing how the capuchins being used in laboratory experiments, but look how smart they are and look at how wonderful they are, then people were outraged. When we saw it, when we started it with farm animals, then a lot of people went vegan. So there's a guy called the Lion Man out there, and he bonds with these wonderful creatures. He is one of the few who can do this. But millions and millions of people have watched this, and it alters their perception of what these animals are. They're not just ferocious killing machines. You know, that they also can see the love in them and the emotion in them. I'm not suggesting people go out and bomb with a wild animal. I'm suggesting that we as a society need to see them in a different light if we're to be motivated not to want to see them harmed and to be angered when they are, and that allows us to then use our body politic to engage in legislative action to protect them, because we will go out of our way. Remember, 27,000 children die every day on the planet, every day, without exception, and it's higher frequently. Yet watch one child get caught in a landfill. Watch what happens. The whole world watches, right? Holding its breath. I believe that we need to see that one white lion in a different way, and then I believe that you'll have millions of people joining your cause. That's just my input. Your thoughts, please. Your final thoughts.
Gary, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, there is such a lion cub that carried my story along. And, you know, love actually is the greatest force, I think, in all of us. You know, a mother's love, or a love for your child, that unconditional love. This cub was prophesied, actually, and was born in one of these killing camps I mentioned, in a place called Bethlehem on Christmas Day. How's that? It just was indicative of showing that God exists in nature, even in these hell holes that have been created by captive breeding trophy hunting operators. And that cub then formed the absolute focus of my campaign to ensure the return of the white lions back to their ancestral homelands, whatever it takes. And you, my book details, you know, it took police raids, it took a kind of gun battle, it took court action, presentations to parliament, international awareness campaigns. But finally, 6 years later, we opened the gates to freedom for that lion cub, who returned back to her kingdom and had her own cubs in the wild and survived magnificently, hunting for herself and her cubs. So that story is detailed in my book, and it will be a movie. The script is being completed now. That way we can get the message out, because, as you know, no conservation issue today It belongs to one country. It is all a global issue. If Absolutely. Brazil destroys its rainforests, we've lost our lungs. If South Africa destroys the white lions, we've lost the symbol of leadership and kingship and all those good things, the Lion King, for our children.
Have you seen that clip of the two men who return to see what happened?
Yes, I know. I, in fact, know the one man, John Rendell. He bought that cub in Harrods in London. You know, that in those days, you could just go and buy a cub. Can you believe it? But he does return it to the wild, and the lion recognizes him years later and comes bounding up to greet him.
Thank you for all that you're doing, Linda.
Thank you, thank you. If anyone would like to visit my site, it's whitelions.org, and you can sign a petition there calling for the protection of the white lions.
We will. We'll be on top of this. Linda Tucker, the book is Saving the White Lions, One Woman's Battle for Africa's Most Sacred Animal. The website is whitelions.org. Thank you very much, and all the best to you.
Thank you. Thank you for your work, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll, and that completes our program. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen. We look forward to sharing more on our next program. Now, on our talkback segment, 888-874-4888, we have Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary.
Luann, what's on your agenda today? We only have about 4 minutes.
I really wanted to go over what's happening with this retreat in Texas. We're getting an amazing feedback from your audience already, really clamoring to get down there, and I wanted to give people some information about it. You know, at the Tri-State Healing Center that you used to have, it was one of these one-stop places for health and well-being and learning about sustainable living. And we've not had a place since. I had my center on 28th Street for about 3 or 4 years, and that was a different environment for alternative healing. Well, this place that we're going to be convening at in Texas pretty much pulls it all together. Here you have not only the serenity and beauty of a world-class healing environment, you have hands-on classes and cooking and juicing and raw foods and gardening. There's nature walks. Meditation workshops.
Let's do this. We're running out of time here. Let me just say that I don't know if we even have any spaces left yet. So before we talk about having anyone else come, I was told today that we're full for the retreat. And you are right. There is a need for people to be able to get away for a couple weeks and just rebalance their life, to cleanse, to de-stress, to learn about their bodies, to be able to be with nature in a very beautiful way, with swans and with lake and the woods and the workshops. The workshops are going to be spectacular.
Life-transforming, Gary.
They will be life-transforming. Remember, your life was transformed when you were there for 2 weeks down in Texas.
It was amazing.
At the Healing Springs Ranch. But you also remember at the end of the first week you were leaving because your conditioning didn't allow you to fully understand or appreciate the gourmet vegan meals and the stress workshop. Sean Bhatnagar was there that weekend, that week you were there. And it was only in the second week that you really got it all and came back. And that's when you came back and changed your career. You went from a nurse administrator with a very high-paying job and security, and you went into you spent almost a year and a half studying and seeing for yourself, was this stuff real at the Tri-State Healing Center? That's what you referred to. And the answer is yes. When you finally said, and I ask you, I never will forget, we were going down the steps one night. It was after 11:30 because people stayed late there. And I turned to you and I said, it's a year and a half. Have you figured it out? And you said, yeah. This is real healing. And then you went on your journey to become a holistic nurse healer. So we're going to get all of this insight in inspiring healing energy at this two-week retreat. I just don't know if we have any more room because I like to keep it small enough so everyone gets counseling time, the workshops, the yoga workshops, the meditation workshops, the energy workshops, the cooking classes.
I wanted to add one more thing.
What?
I want to let each attendee know that I'm going to give them a personal health counseling session. And that's for anyone, whether you're dealing with a chronic illness, whether you want to just reverse aging, whether you're just stressed out. Every single person who attends this retreat, Gary, is going to get a personal health counseling by me.
Oh, great. That's nice. And, of course, I'm going to be there at night doing workshops as well. So I don't know if we have any space left. If you call, they'll tell you. Let me give you the number. It's 877-627-5065. It starts on with an orientation on Sunday, the 7th of July. It's after the fourth weekend. It's cheap tickets. No problem. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. You can come for 1 or 2 weeks. It's only $2,000 for the first week. And if you stay a second week, it drops down to $1,500. And that's for all the juicing and classes and workshops and counseling. That's for all that you get. And if you're in the hotel, I pay even for the hotel. So all you have to do is get yourself there. So how about that? But again, right at this moment, I don't know if we have any space left. So 877-627-5065. Thanks, everyone. Now over to Utrece Lee. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about a lawsuit in Paris that opens a closed chapter on reparations and a lawsuit in Chicago that seeks to reopen the doors of closed schools.
We look forward to listening to you now, Utrece Lee.